You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. Senator Sanders is traveling today. He is in Phoenix, Arizona. He will be with us for a full hour for Brunch with Bernie. But instead of being the first hour of our program, it will be the third hour of our program. So he will be with us 2 hours from now. So we're going to do Anything Goes Friday for the first 2 hours rather than the last 2 hours of our program today. So whatever your thoughts may be, whatever your comments, concerns, calls, whatever, if you want to pick a topic, I want to cover a bunch of things that are in the news first, just because that's my job, I guess, is to let you know what's going on. And there are some significant things going on today. The BRIC nations, you've heard this phrase, BRIC. It's actually now increasingly being considered five countries: Brazil, Russia, India, China, BRIC, and South Africa. So pretty soon they'll probably start calling it BRICA or BRICUS or something like that. But in any case, the BRIC nations, these nations constitute a significant portion of the population of the world, roughly, I think, about 30-40%. And they and a very significant, about a quarter of the economy of the world. It's really, really significant. And they are growing like crazy. China and India, for example, are going to see, in all probability this year, growth rates of 8 and 7% respectively. Russia's growing at 3-4%. Brazil is running around 4%. South Africa is growing in that neighborhood. The United States, maybe 2% this year, which is actually damn good, considering that when George Bush left, we were sinking. We were in a massive negative mode. But still, only 2%. And in the countries in Europe now, if you take, you know, the Scandinavian countries, they're doing fine. They're growing. It's always a little weird because people say, oh, Europe has all kinds of problems. It's in great trouble. Well, large chunks of Europe are having no problems whatsoever. Thank you very much. But several of the European countries, in particular Portugal, Spain, in particular Greece, actually. But, you know, in aggregate, when you aggregate all that together as the European Union, all the countries that are sharing the euro, which isn't so much the Scandinavian countries because most of them still have their own currencies. When you look at the euro nations, they're looking, because they've bought into this Milton Friedman, Tom Friedman austerity nonsense that came out of the Chicago School of Economics in the 1930s and has been adopted by Republicans in the United States. They're trying to inflict that on us. Actually, they are in the red states. You've seen in the red states unemployment continuing to go up, GDP continuing to go down because they're cutting taxes and giving more tax breaks to billionaires and big corporations and refusing to spend money on investing in their states. Whereas in the blue states, you've got the states are actually growing. But nonetheless, here in the U.S., we have an average of 2% growth. And Europe is looking at a negative 0.5% because of this insane austerity stuff. So what the BRIC nations are doing is they're saying, you know, the IMF and the World Bank, you guys are nuts. And we don't want to be dependent upon you if we want to do some sort of major construction project or invest in our country, or if we get in trouble. So we're going to create our own multilateral bank. It's pretty amazing stuff. I know it sounds a little wonky around the edges, but let me boil it down into a sentence. The countries that have been investing aggressively in their own infrastructure, building high-speed rail, building highways, building schools, putting their young people to school for free, passing national health care programs as China did last year, free single-payer health care system. Those countries are growing. And they're looking at us and at the European countries that are cutting back on their programs. Greece, 30% cut in their minimum wage, 40% cut in their health care programs. This is austerity, right, to pay off the banksters. a disaster that Goldman Sachs set up in the first place. And us, the United States and Europe, the austerity countries, the countries that are following the conservative slash Republican slash neoliberal point of, you know, and that's not liberal in the American sense. That's the way they use the word in Europe, that are following that, we're screwed. So we're going to be stuck with the IMF and the World Bank. They're going to have their own bank. And, you know, back in 1996, when I wrote the first edition of Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight, I had spent a decade earlier, I'd spent a month in Beijing studying acupuncture at the International Acupuncture Training Hospital there, a 500-bed hospital. And one of the doctors there made the comment to me over lunch one day that the 20th century had been the American century, but the 21st century was going to be the Chinese century. And at that time, in 1986, walking around the streets of Beijing, where all the back streets, every street would have a big pile of briquettes of coal that people would use to heat their homes. It was November. It was a cold month. And the air hung gray with the smoke, and people lived in one room of their house during the winter because they only wanted to heat one room. And people, it was a very poor country. The tallest building in the city of Beijing was either the Sheraton or Hilton. I think it was a Sheraton hotel that was 8 stories high. It also had the only really high-quality American food restaurant. You could buy a meal in Beijing for 2 cents. A meal, a whole meal. 2 U.S. cents. Back in 1986, they were poor. I stood on Tiananmen Square. This was the year before. This was before the whole, you know, Tiananmen Square thingy-bob, uprising. I stood on that square, and there's this main highway, main road, big 8-lane, you know, with a median down the middle, 8-10-lane road that runs out in front of it. And it was just a sea of black bicycles, and maybe once every 5 minutes you'd see a single car go by. Louise and I, back in 83 or 84, took a trip to Shenzhen, which is where Foxconn is, which is where they make apples and things. And that was called the New Territories back then. We were visiting Hong Kong, and China had just opened up the new territories. And at that time, Hong Kong was still a property of Great Britain, and you could make this trip across the strait to the land side into the new what they call the new territories, and you could take this bus trip. It was about a 4-hour bus trip to Shenzhen, which was the new city. And it was a city of like 20 or 30,000 people. There weren't any paved roads. The main street down the middle had a farmer's market kind of thing where people were selling frogs and little ducklings and birds and snakes and monkeys and things that you could buy to make food out of. And there was one restaurant in town, and again, you could get a meal for 20 cents. And Louise had to help one elderly woman to use the restroom there. And this was the fanciest restaurant in town. The restroom was a hole in the floor. This was what China was like in the 80s. Look at the pictures now. Look back at the pictures of the Olympics. How did they do it? They grew their way out of it. They invested in their country. They did the exact opposite of what the Republicans want us to do. Grover Norquist wants to shrink us down to the size where our government can be drowned in a bathtub. Meanwhile, the BRIC countries, China, Brazil, India, Russia, and increasingly South Africa, they're saying, you guys are nuts. We're going to do what you did in the 1940s, 50s, 60s, 70s. We're going to grow our country and become great industrial powers. And we have been living on Reaganomics for 35 years. There are 32 years, and now we're living on fumes because Reaganomics has ripped this country apart. So anyhow, my opening rant for the day, I got to tell you about the postal workers, more and more Americans moving into the slums. Amnesty International has a report on Afghanistan. I'll tell you about that quickly after the break, and then we will pick up your calls on Anything Goes Friday.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And our telephone number, of course, 866-987-THOM. And if you want to drop in and hang out with some of the finest minds on the planet, and I don't mean that facetiously, go to TomHartman.com, click community, and join our chat room. Anything goes. Okay, we are going to get to your calls in just a second. I just want to run through this really quickly. The postal workers, the post office has just announced they're closing 223 mail processing plants, 35,000 layoffs. Why? Because in 2006, the Bush administration and the Republicans in Congress passed a law saying that the post office had to, over a 10-year period, from 2006 to 2016, that the post office had, during that 10-year period, to fully fund, and it's put the money in the bank, fully all the money in the bank, for the retirement of the health benefit retirements, retirement health benefits of their employees 75 years out. In other words, they had to put the money in the bank now to pay for health benefits for people who haven't even been born, but 75 years from now are going to retire from the post office. This was a poison pill. Now, why would they do this? Why would they go after the post office? Because it is the largest unionized employer in the United States. This is part, you know, Ronald Reagan went after the unions with Patco. George W. Bush went after the unions by trying to take down the post office. And so here we see the post office, this great American institution mentioned in the Constitution of the United States, created by Ben Franklin, brought down, killed off, wounded anyway, by George W. Bush. 8 million more children are living in high poverty areas now than when George Bush became president. That's a 20% increase since the year 2000. Not only was Reaganomics bad for our country, Bushonomics was even worse. And finally, Amnesty International is pointing out that 400 civilians in Afghanistan, these are people who have nothing to do with combat or the war or the Taliban or anything, 400 average citizens every single day are being displaced. They're losing their homes. They're having to flee war-torn areas. They're whatever. And as a result of this, they're homeless. You have a 500,000 Afghan civilians living on the edge of starvation right now. And just in the last month, in the month of January, over 24 Afghan children froze to death. Froze to death. This is the true face of war. And in the midst of this, you've got a bunch of Republicans who are going, bomb, 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 around. They want another war. Whoever said war is hell was understating the issue. Okay, now to your calls. John in Minneapolis. Hey, John, what's up?
Yeah, I just wanted to link the GOP and their current attitude and, you know, to relate even your last statement about how they're just interested in war all the time and they are always rattling. But I'm sure you probably come across, as a lot of people have, Karl Popper's quote from the open society and its enemies.
Yes.
And, you know, I want to say that my great-grandfather, grandfather, and father fought to have a liberal democracy, a tolerant democracy, and these people are undermining it. And they used to tell, people on the left, you know, America, love it or leave it, you're a communist, you want violent overthrow of the government. Well, maybe they're not violently overthrowing the government, but they are doing violence to us in the name of their, you know, doctrines.
Yes.
Milton Friedman is a good example. And you know, Milton Friedman's philosophy is deterministic. It's just as evil, as far as I'm concerned, as a Marxian economist. It's not balanced. It takes into consideration only one thing, and that is profit and greed. How does that relate to their Christian worldview?
Yeah.
I mean, they're just such hypocrites. And
no,
I'm
totally with you, John. And I would actually, I'd cut a little slack to the Marxian economists, because I believe that Marx's analysis of capitalism was right. I believe his policy prescriptions
absolutely
were wrong.
I agree with
but his analysis was right. And most economists will grant you that. John, thank you very much for the call. Very, very well said. Jim in Alto, Texas. Hey, Jim, what's up?
Thank you for taking my call, Tom.
Sure.
I hope to talk to Bernie Sanders, but I get another
call patriot. Call back in an hour and a half. He'll be on.
No. I've got another patriot to talk to.
Okay. All right. Thanks.
Listen, it's about the oil prices, the gas prices. I talked to Sanders' office, and they said the president has the authority to order the Commerce Department to put a ban on all petroleum products. That would put a glut in the market right there.
Yes. If we were, you're absolutely right, and this we talked about this yesterday on the program, if the president were to stop the export of refined petroleum products, because gasoline is now our number one export here in the United States, and if he were to say you can no longer export gasoline from the United States, it has to stay here, suddenly there would be such a glut of gasoline, you'd probably see the price of gas around $2 a barrel, $2 a gallon, rather. You're absolutely right, Jim. Thank you for that call. Well said. Tim in Linville, Indiana. Hey, Tim, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom, how are you doing?
Great. What's up?
Well, I'm calling from, like you said, the foxified state of Indiana and our great leader.
You and Mitch Daniels.
Yeah. Yes, sir.
You have my sympathy.
Well, the legislature and Mitch has passed legislation that we will no longer accept funding for Medicare and Medicaid in Indiana, and I'm wondering what the implications of this is, and I'll take your grant line.
Yeah, well, what they're basically trying to say is that they don't want to have anything to do with Obamacare, and this is because, you know, much of Obamacare runs through Medicare and Medicaid, and you know, begins the kind of merging of those systems with not so much with corporate private health care, but filling in the cracks. They're using those systems to fill in the cracks. And you've got a half a dozen or so really hardcore right-wing crank governors, Mitch Daniels is one of them, who are saying, you know, the law requires us to set up these exchanges now to get ready for Obamacare in 2014, and there are some benefits that the federal government will give you. The federal government will give you the states the money to do that, to set up the exchanges, and we're not going to do that. You know, we're just not going to play. And that's what's going on. And you know, it's really a sad thing because it's purely a political game. And the pawns that are being moved around by Mitch Daniels and some of these other Republican governors are the people who are on Medicare and Medicaid. They're the ones who are going to be hurt so that they can make a political point. And then when those people are hurt, they're going to try and blame the president, just like they're doing with the gas prices.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Back with your calls on Anything Goes Friday here on the Tom Hartman Program, 27 minutes past the hour.
Went to Iraq, caught lots of flak. No turning back to war with delicious attack. And Bomberan, bomb, 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 bomberan.
Yeah, Bomberan. That's the Republican mantra today. Sad thing. Did you see these pictures of Romney's speech he's given in Detroit right now? It's like 1,200 people showed up in a 65,000-person stadium. And over at Think Progress, just below the Eric Setzwald, Alex Setzwald, Seitzwald, posted this. And just below the picture of Romney, where he's got this little cluster of people at the 30-yard line, is the picture from Obama in 2008 at the XL Convention Center in Hartford, where he filled the arena. Pretty amazing. We'll see where this all goes. Cece in Pagosa Springs, Colorado. Hey, Cece, what's up?
Good morning, Tom. Libertarianism.
Yeah.
I have got a theory about it, and I want to get into a discussion with you very briefly. I think we're already there. Example, I have a friend who lost her job 3 years ago. She's now 60. She went to social services because she ran out of unemployment and all of her savings, and they told her she was too young. They might be able to give her some food stamps, and that was so that means that down the road she's probably going to lose her home because she has no money coming in, and it goes on and on. There's no safety. People talk about a safety net. When you go in there to social services, she said she felt like a criminal. You're grilled, you're questioned, all these forms as thick as a manuscript that you have to fill out with everything but your blood. And we're there, Tom. I mean, we're already there. What do you think?
I think you're right. And an awful lot of it was ending welfare as we know it during the Clinton administration that was spearheaded actually by Newt Gingrich. And I think Bill Clinton just kind of rode that wave. And also there's been, you know, a steady destruction of the social safety net during the Bush administration that largely went unnoticed because he wasn't waving the flag around about it. But yeah, it is. And then the Republicans, they just passed this extension of unemployment benefits, and the Democrats said, give us 99 weeks. And the Republicans said, no, we'll give you, what was it, 76 weeks, 67 weeks, something like that. And that's it. I mean, the libertarian philosophy is, I refer to libertarians as Republicans who want to smoke dope and get laid. I would say we're not yet there with the libertarian stuff yet, because they haven't completely destroyed the entire social safety net, which is what libertarians want to do. They want to do away with all government support programs. They think everything should be run by a corporation or a billionaire or somebody who inherited their wealth, like the hero and heroine of Atlas Shrugged, you know, Ayn Rand's book. And so we still have Social Security and Medicare and Medicaid and food stamps, and all of these things are things that libertarians, Rand Paul, would do away with tomorrow morning if they had a chance. And any kind of support for people in housing assistance, et cetera, all those things in a libertarian worldview should be done away with. On the other hand, the libertarians want to decriminalize all drugs and prostitution. So while you can't afford to eat and you can't afford to pay for your home and you've got no healthcare services, you can have sex if you've got a little extra change, you know, with somebody who's willing to sell those services, and you can get high. So, you know, it's a pretty grim dystopian view, CC, of the libertarians. But I thank you for sharing that story with us. I think you're right. We are definitely moving in that direction, and we need to move in another direction, in the opposite direction, frankly. George in Chicago. Hey, George, what's up?
Hey, thanks for taking my call, Tom. In the last couple of weeks or so, you've brought up the point that the teabaggers over the last several years have been organized and trained by, unless I'm mistaken, the Concord Coalition.
Among others. And that's one of about four organizations that have put together on their websites, and you can Google them, videos and YouTubes on how to become precinct committee persons. Yeah.
I think there may be a bit of confusion here about similar names. As you probably recall, the Concord Coalition was established in the 90s by Republican Senator Warren Rudman of New Hampshire and Democratic Senator Paul Saugus of Massachusetts as a reasonable, intelligent, middle-of-the-road advocacy organization for budgeting and taxation.
So the one I'm referring to is the Concord Project, right?
Yeah, and I have good friends who were very active in the Concord Coalition back then, and I was actually a dues-paying member myself for a while, and the Concord Coalition and the teabaggers have virtually nothing in common. And
thank you, George, for setting that record straight. It's the Concord Project that I've been quoting, and bad on me for the brain fart, because I remember the Concord Coalition, too, and that's why it was sticking in my head. But the Concord Project... Go ahead.
Could I ask you a question about Rick Santorum?
Yeah.
I mean, you've talked last week or so about his attack on federal and state support for public schools, and that this should be something that's left entirely to local people. And yet he's campaigning for the nomination in Michigan and apparently leading in the polls or close to it. But it would seem like what he's saying about school policy puts him on a collision course with the governor of Michigan, who is managing school districts and local governments from his governor's office. I mean, is there any public debate going back and forth between the governor and Senator Santorum, or are they just like pretending they don't disagree on this?
That's interesting. Governor Snyder I have never had this conversation with him, so I can't state this as a fact, but in my opinion, Governor Snyder would love to see all the schools in the state of Michigan privatized. I mean, that's the Republican mantra these days. Turn them all into charter schools, turn them all into for-profit schools, you know, get the government out of the business. And he has taken over at least one school district near Detroit, and one of those was a very, very successful school. It's just a shame what he's doing. Santorum, my call for local control of schools is not for entirely local funding of schools. There's a nuance to what I'm suggesting. I think that local control of schools is a really good thing, that local communities should have a lot of say in how their schools are run and you know, a whole variety of things, who the teachers are and whatnot. On the other hand, I do think that there have to be some national standards, and there have to be some national support. You don't want, for example, schools in deep southern, and having lived in Atlanta for 13 years, I have some familiarity with this, in deep southern poor communities teaching that kind of the Ku Klux Klan version of the Civil War. There needs to be some kind of oversight on some of those things. There are some things that I think nationally we should all agree should be part of curriculum. And also, you don't want poor school districts having poor schools because they don't have a good tax base, and rich communities having good schools because they do have a good tax base. And that's where you need to equalize that out with federal funding. But that said, I also think that it's really important that local people get involved, that local school boards have a significant degree of autonomy and power. And that's kind of a middle ground position. That's something that, you know, both Democrats and Republicans will say, well, yes, maybe, and on. But that's my take on it. Okay,
well,
George.
That actually sounds quite Jeffersonian, and
it sounds
quite reasonable. But
yeah.
But I'm just struck by the fact that Republicans are so focused on yanking people's emotional chains that they don't consider being consistent a virtue, even when they're conflicting with each other. And it's
no.
a major figure. Like
See,
the
they, you have to understand. Right now, for Republicans, they have two goals. One is to make the very rich as rich as possible, because they're the funders of the Republicans. And number two is to win. And so, truth be damned, policy be damned, good of the country be damned, fate of our kids be damned. Make the rich people rich and win elections, no matter what you have to say or do to do so. And people are catching on to that, I think, but not enough people. And we need to keep pounding on that. George, thanks a lot for the call. Dan in Sterling Heights, Michigan, listening to WDTW. Hey, Dan, what's up?
Greetings, Tom. Happy Friday. I knew there was a pungent air in Michigan this morning for a reason. I forgot that Romney was down at Ford Field, but thanks for reminding me. A quick comment about words, Tom. Having read a number of your books, I know that you know that words matter. And I think that my comments are in terms of creating a dialogue which is going to turn the ship of the perception of the populace in general as it relates to income and taxation. And a lot of people use the word income equality in this country, and I'm leaving out the ratio of CEO pay to worker pay, and I think that there are inequities in income. But leaving that out, I think we need to start talking generally about we don't have income inequality, we have tax inequality. And I think that most people, especially independents, would react much better to saying, you can earn what you want, right? The land of opportunity. We're not going to penalize you for being smart and being an entrepreneur and a business owner and earning money, but everybody has to pay the same percentage. And I just think if we can start using different words, we can slowly start.
Or everybody has to pay a fair percentage, because if everybody pays the same percentage, then you've got somebody living in poverty having to pay taxes that forces them further into poverty, and somebody who's very rich paying a very, very low tax rate. So, I'm with you on that. I would say also, we talk about income inequality. I'm frankly more concerned about wealth inequality. When you look at the fact that African American families in the United States, and this is the result of 500 years of institutionalized racism, which continues to this day, nowhere near as badly, but let's face it, it continues to this day. African American families in America, on average, have less than $10,000 in wealth. And white families have about $80,000 in wealth. Those numbers, those are like different starting points for each generation of children. And that's something we have to address.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
In fact, that difference in wealth is one dimension of something that many people refer to as white privilege, that I think a lot of white people, frankly, don't understand.
I don't want that.
Speaking the truth to multinational corporations, we'd really rather you didn't know all about. Tom Hartman here with you. Robert in Phoenix, Arizona, listening on 1480 KPHX. Hey, Robert, what's up?
Hey, Tom, you're a great American, and thank you for taking my call.
Thank you.
My question to you is, I want your opinion on this, is in an effort to be fairest to all people without any discrimination, shouldn't all the county, state, and federal government completely remove any reference in the tax code to married couples? And why is the government involved in these different states going through these social issues as to whether we're going to allow gay marriage or not? why are we in that at all? Shouldn't we just leave that to the church? And shouldn't, because I'm basically for gay marriage, but aren't we making it a lot harder trying to mesh the two?
What you're describing, Robert, is the original rationale for civil unions. I was living in Vermont when Vermont became the first state in the union to have civil unions. Howard Dean was governor. We'd live just three blocks from the Capitol. We could watch out our windows as Fred Phelps and his crazy Westboro Baptist Church people were out there going, you know, the state is going to catch on fire if you do this and all this other nonsense. And the idea was, okay, civil unions, you know, there are all these benefits that we give people when they get married, just like benefits that we give people when they incorporate, because we want to encourage that behavior. We think that there's a social good that comes out of people doing business, and we think that there's a social good that comes out of people being married. And so we offer things like, you know, inheritance and visitation and, you know, unique privileges that you have as a consequence of this. So let's try doing this with civil unions. And what we discovered in Vermont was, you know, civil unions was a great start, but there are the word marriage occurs in, as I recall, either over 10,000 or over 14,000 different federal, state, and county laws. And to nationally purge that or change that will be virtually impossible. I think what you're describing, though, you know, cleaving the civil marriage from the religious marriage is happening to a large extent right now. What is happening is, and has been for a long time. You know, when I was growing up, the Catholic Church did not recognize divorced people as, you know, being divorced, and didn't recognize remarriages as legitimate marriages. You know, Newt wouldn't have been in the Catholic Church of my childhood. At least this is my understanding of it. I'm not Catholic, so I can't say this as an absolute fact, but my recollection was that you had to get an annulment, and to get an annulment, you had to demonstrate that you'd never consummated your marriage, you'd never had sex. And if you had kids, that made it pretty difficult to get an annulment. And, you know, so there was a cleavage even back then. You know, you had various churches saying, okay, this is our definition of marriage, but you had federal, state, and local governments saying, no, this is our definition of marriage. I remember in the 1980s, I believe it was, Louise and I were traveling through Ireland, and there was a billboard where it showed a mother and a child holding hands, and they both had tears in their eyes. And the headline, giant headline, said, "Don't let it happen. Vote no on 14 or whatever the proposition was. And I couldn't figure out. I was seeing these billboards all over Ireland. I couldn't figure out what it was. I finally asked somebody, and they said, "Oh, we're having a debate about whether to decriminalize divorce." Divorce was against the law in Ireland at that time. This was in the late 70s, early 80s. And Ireland eventually decriminalized divorce, separated themselves from the Catholic Church in that regard. And the church was pushing really, really hard to keep divorce illegal, to not allow the state to recognize divorce. So I think that as we move toward gay marriage, you know, and in the United States back in the 50s and 60s, I mean, it was, I think, 65 when the last state declared miscegenation illegal, or maybe it was the Supreme Court, whatever it was, that we did away with, you know, it's illegal to marry between races. So the definitions have changed, but I think that's the bottom line, Robert. I think you put your finger on it, but the only practical way to do it is just to go ahead and use the word marriage in law, and then let the churches figure out how they're going to reconcile it, how they're going to deal with it. And some will come along and others won't, and that's fine. That's fine. And people can always get married by a justice of the peace. Thanks for the call. An excellent one. Jim in Las Vegas, Nevada. Hey, Jim, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Hey, have you seen the documentary Inside Job?
Yes, I have. It's brilliant.
Really good.
I recommend it to everybody.
Yeah, it is. Well, I'm so angry that these banksters that ruined our economy, and they still got their bonuses, and they're still getting money from the Federal Reserve at 1% interest.
Yeah, there's a new documentary. There's a new documentary coming out next week. It's going to be released in New York City called Heist, and I'll give more information about it after the break. That stars Bernie Sanders, among others, and that is narrated by me. And they're doing their opening theater release in New York City starting next week. So it's called Heist, H-E-I-S-T.
Uh-huh.
And
great.
It's kind of the follow-on to the. Go ahead.
My hero and your hero, Bernie. He's a co-sponsor of a bill in the Senate to keep the student loans percentage is down. Now, these banksters are getting money and making big money on their money that they're getting practically for free, and us students are paying, and the Republicans want to do away with the 3.5% interest rate.
Right.
And jack it up to 6 or 7 or even higher percent.
Yeah.
And Bernie is co-sponsoring a bill. I wanted to see if you could ask him, if I'm one of the guys that got stuck by these for-profit colleges.
Oh, my.
Now, I don't know if I can mention the name of it, but I went, and I have a student loan for $14,000. I was promised the world that when I got out of this school, I was going to be able to do this and do that. And 2 years later, I still haven't been able to find a job because all they care about is moving people in and out of these for-profit schools.
That's right. And putting you in debt if they can and making a good interest rate off it.
And putting me in debt, and it's guaranteed by the federal government, so the banks aren't going to lose anything. But instead of having counselors, they call them counselors, but they're high-pressure salespeople.
Yeah.
And I went in asking for a few questions. I thought I'm a pretty intelligent guy. And the next thing, I'm signing on the dotted line, and I'm not going to be able to get a job. Now I'm going to the community college to get a really accredited field that I was going to school.
Now, we need to do something about this. At the very least, more tightly regulate these for-profit colleges. I'm absolutely with you, Jim. And I know Bernie is, too. Thanks a lot for the call.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Senator Sanders will be with us in 60 minutes for Brunch with Bernie. He's on the road today in Phoenix, or in Arizona, actually. I'm not sure what city he's in. And so we will be doing the show a little later than normal. But he will be with us. And the movie that I mentioned in the last hour that is opening in New York City next week, March 2nd through the 8th at New York City's Quad Cinema. That's at 34 West 13th Street in New York City. Down on the west side in 13th Street, the Quad Cinema. And the movie is called Heist. And if you want to know more about it and pick up tickets and all that kind of stuff, by the way, there's going to be a special screening on March 4th. They're going to have sponsored by Demos featuring Robert Kuttner. Special screening on March 6th featuring David K. Johnston. And they're all in the movie along with Bernie Sanders. And on March 8th, the special screening feature Eric Kingson, co-director of Strength and Social Security. These will all be again at the New York Quad Cinema, 34 West 13th Street in Manhattan, next week. And those of you listening on WWRL, I believe is going to be giving out some free tickets for this thing. So keep an eye out for that. So. Anyhow, but the if you want all the information on the movie and you want to see the trailer and all that kind of stuff, it's heist-themovie.com. Heist-themovie. And it's the story of how we got heisted by the banksters. And I think you will recognize the voice of the guy doing the narration on this movie. It's a brilliant, brilliant movie, a brilliant screenplay. When I read it, I said, this is it. This is what people need to know. And they've just done a marvelous, marvelous job with this movie. So strongly encourage you to check it out. 866-987-THOM, our telephone number, Larry in Williamsburg, Iowa. Hey, Larry, what's on your mind today?
Well, that right to work law that was filed in Indiana.
Yeah, let's call it the correct name, Right to Work for Less.
Okay. Anyway. If they win that, how would that affect other states that already got it into effect?
If they win, you're talking about the union that is challenging it on three different bases, if they win the lawsuit, the challenging the Right to Work for Less law?
Yes.
I don't know, because I don't know how the Indiana law was constructed. If my understanding of this, and I'm not a labor law lawyer or authority or expert, so I'm giving you a very, I've been around the block a few times, and I've been watching this for a lot of years, but this, This may be subject to revision, but my understanding is that in 1935, when the Wagner Act was passed, the National Labor Relations Act was passed, basically it said that if a majority of people vote to have a union shop, that everybody who works there has to be a member of that union and has to pay dues to the union and has to participate in the union, or doesn't have to, but can participate in the union. But basically everybody who gets the benefit from the union also has to help pay for the union. And Taft-Hartley in 1947, which was passed during the two-year period when Republicans controlled the House of Representatives, the two-year period from 1932 until 1986. They lost the House again and didn't get it back for another 40 years. Taft-Hartley says that individual states can choose to opt out of some of the specific provisions of the Wagner Act, of the National Labor Relations Act, and one of them being that everybody who is in a union shop has to join the union. And then there are a few others. And so whether, and most right to work for less states have basically become that by simply saying, we're invoking our privilege under Taft-Hartley to opt out of those provisions of the Wagner Act. If Indiana did it in a way that was not the usual, not the way that it's been done in the past, if they did it in a way that was more extreme than that, which wouldn't surprise me at all, if they did it in a way that identified or targeted specific groups of unions, particularly public employee unions, as Scott Walker tried to do in Wisconsin, then I think it's entirely conceivable that the law could be struck down. Then they would just come out with the more generic version that most right to work for less states have. And if it's a unique law, which is the thing that I don't know. But if they're going after it because it's a unique law, then I don't think it would affect all the other right to work for less states. It may make it more difficult for future ALEC-sponsored, Koch brothers-sponsored legislation to use Taft-Hartley and then go a step beyond it. But I think that Taft-Hartley is still there. That's the core of the problem. And frankly, I've been saying for the 9 years I've been doing this show, we need to roll back Taft-Hartley. Taft-Hartley needs to be repealed. And I have not had a single member of organized labor from Rich Trumka on down disagree with me on that. So I'm sorry I don't have a definitive answer for you, Larry. You might want to check our chat room. They're really good at tracking this kind of stuff down and getting the information out. I'll check it during the next break and see, you know, if anybody's tracked that down, and I'll report back to you, okay?
All right.
Thank you very much, Larry. Thanks for the call. Good to hear from you. And much appreciated. Let's see here. Teresa in Raymond, Washington. Hey, Teresa. Hey, thanks for listening on our iPhone app. What's up?
Hi, Tom. I'm an impoverished, childless, disabled, homeless property owner that's forced to pay for other people's children's education. And I just want to say, I hope they get addicted to it. I hope it enlightens them, and I hope they have to pay for it themselves.
Okay. All right. I got it. Thank you very much. I personally think that we should all pay for everybody's children's education, whether we have children or not, because we all benefit from those children growing up and being smart firemen and firefighters and police officers and doctors and workers in our factories and knowing how to make change in the grocery store and, you know, fill in the blank. I think that the good that we get, whether we have children or not, from having all of our children well educated, far outweighs the unfairness of people who don't have children having to pay a very, very small portion of their taxes. For the average working person, it works out to probably less than $40 or $50 a year in taxes to help pay for the education of all our children. But I respect your right to disagree with me. And Melanie in Sand Lake, Michigan. Hey, Melanie, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. I'm a public school teacher here in West Michigan and have a snow day, so it's so wonderful to be able to listen to you.
Oh, great.
I'm just calling about this. I call it the Great War on Public Education. I just think the assault is incredible. Unfortunately, I think President Obama's been a four-star general in this assault, and it's not something that's talked about that often in that frame. I would just wonder if you had a moment just to maybe talk to your listeners about what the United States could possibly look like or will look like when all education is corporatized and privatized.
Well, we'll look like Somalia. I mean, it will look like where it's not corporatized, it's churchicized, but you know the same difference. You've got a group with a particular special interest running education, whether it's a religious special interest or a for-profit special interest. I think I'm looking at the American education scene here, and I've been very involved in it for years. I wrote 7 books on education and learning disabilities. I've been on the board of a private school, which takes kids that are just way beyond the ability of public schools to deal with, mostly because of their behavior and their learning disabilities. And I think that there's a need for that kind of thing, frankly. But yeah, we don't compete with public schools at all. And we take referrals from public schools. But I think that and I've done a lot of consulting work to public schools over the years. Back in the 90s, it was something that I was doing a lot of. And what I'm seeing, I agree with you, is this war on public education.
Yeah.
And the most important point I would make is that the two countries in the world that have the best outcomes, the best educational outcomes for their public school students are Singapore and Finland. And in those two countries, teachers are paid the same as doctors. Teachers have the same level of social respect as doctors. And when we achieve that in the United States, then we'll have those kinds of world-class outcomes. Melanie, I'm sorry we're out of time. Thank you for your call, and thanks for your time.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Yes, there are some things that you can throw money at, and you get a good outcome. And education is one of them, I can tell you. And anybody who's been through school knows that.
In olden days, a glimpse of stocking was looked on as something shocking. Now heaven knows anything goes.
Anything goes. Friday Brunch with Bernie will be coming up in 40 minutes. And Scott in Los Angeles listening on K-Talk. Hey, Scott, what's on your mind?
Hey, Tom. I'm so great to have another chat with you again. I just couldn't help myself because listening to all this information being thrown around about public education and certainly about the funding of public education. And I don't know if you're familiar with it, but over here in Los Angeles there's just an absolute huge scandal going on with the LA Unified School District with all these sex abuses and just a numerous number of other issues dealing with their mishandling of the budgets and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And of course the right wing radio hosts and many of the other media outlets here are very much taking up the the banter, as it were, to certainly push for an overhaul of the situation and privatizing the schools, and certainly the pushing charter schools as being the predominant option. And I wanted to give people a little bit of hope in the sense of sort of just explaining in New Zealand. I don't know how it is in Australia, but I know in New Zealand the public school system is actually run kind of like a charter school in the sense that the school itself makes its board of directors through the PTA.
Mm-hmm.
And, everyone from the secretary to the treasurer and whatnot, every 3 years has to essentially stand for re-election and give an accounting of what they've done.
Right.
And the government provides the money on a 3-year basis.
Mm-hmm.
So the school gets a lump sum payment ahead of time for the next 3 years, and then it's up to them decide how they allocate funds for, building projects or for other things, as well as covering their basic educational costs.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been working wonderfully. I grew up in a system that I actually was going to high school during the time that the school was trying to save money to replace many of the buildings that were falling apart.
Mm-hmm.
So we had to go through a bit of a period of time there that we didn't have quite as many things, but the teachers and the parents were all involved and were aware of the long-term sort of nature of what the goals were.
Yeah.
And everybody signed on. And
it's great. It sounds like, other than the 3-year versus 1-year funding and things like that, like the main difference between your school system that you grew up with in New Zealand and ours here is that ours here, our school boards are elected generally from the general population, although in some states and some places they're appointed by politicians. And in your case, the Parent Teachers Association, the local PTA, the local school itself, the parents are the ones who presumably run for, certainly vote for, who's going to be on the school board. that is overseeing and administering the schools. And I think that's a marvelous idea. That's a great one.
And it works great because each school, depending upon the location, has its unique needs. Yeah. And, you know, certainly schools in rural areas have a different set of needs for those that are maybe perhaps in the cities.
Yeah, no, it's marvelous. Scott, you made your point great. I've got to move along, but thank you very much for sharing your experience with us. I appreciate it, and thanks for listening to K-Talk. Brian, listening to us on WTKG in Grant, Michigan. Hey, Brian, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Happy Friday.
Thank you.
I want to make a comment regarding the so-called war on religion that's going on right now.
Mm-hmm.
I'm wondering if these people that are claiming this is strictly a First Amendment issue, that you know, they're calling for the payment for birth control and such,
sure,
if they feel the same way if they had an Amish employer who wouldn't pay for ambulance service because it's a motorized vehicle, or a Jewish employer who wouldn't pay for any procedures done on the Sabbath, if they feel the same way.
Yeah, there are many logical extremes to which this could be taken by various religions, and it's not being, and I think your point is well taken. Frankly, though, what's happening now is that you've got these guys, they're not just saying this is about, you know, Catholic hospitals and things like this. They're saying all employers should not be required to offer birth control pills as part, they shouldn't consider birth control pills as a pharmaceutical, as something that is covered under a health insurance plan. And that, in my mind, takes it out of the realm of religion and takes it into the realm of hierarchical, patriarchal, male-dominated societies basically a way of men controlling women, another dimension of that, which I think is...
Yeah, because from a strictly economic standpoint, it's a whole lot less expensive for the health insurance company to pay for the birth control than it is to pay for a birth.
They actually, the health insurance companies actually are more profitable when women use birth control than when they give birth to children. And so it's to their advantage to give away birth control for free, frankly. But men can't control, men can more easily control women's reproduction when women can't control their own ability to control their fertility. And that, I think, is a very real issue. Thanks a lot for the call. Well said. Jim in Denver, Colorado. Hey, Jim, what's up? We got a minute to the break, by the way, Jim.
I'd like to bring something up with you and perhaps with Bernie later on. The FCC was established to regulate our public airwaves, and now the lines between truth and fiction have been blurred by much of the media. I'm wondering, why can't we go to some kind of a Canadian system where the facts are checked out in advance and we know whether something is opinion or it is actual fact? I know that at the top of the hour newscast that you make, you say on the news, which means that you do offer opinion as well, I would imagine.
Well, I make no bones about the fact that I'm all about opinion. First of all, the FCC was established to prevent radio stations from interfering with each other. In the early days, you had stations stepping on each other with their signals, and that's the main reason it was established. It wandered into the territory of controlling content on radio stations secondarily. And then secondly, the First Amendment, which guarantees free speech, you know, we've kind of pulled back from that a little bit with obscenity, but that's going to be your big barrier. They don't have that in Canada, so that's why it probably won't
happen.
You're
listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Back with more of your calls and Anything Goes Friday here on the Tom Hartman Program. Right after this. Yep, that's the good, the bad, and the very, very sterquiliously ugly. Brought to you by EdisonFactor.com, food for your brain. The good. Arlen Specter, of all people, the former Pennsylvania senator, called out his former colleague Rick Santorum over his radical and far-right views. Specter told MSNBC this morning that, quote, when you have Senator Santorum's views so far to the right, with his attitude on women in the workplace and gays and the bestiality comments and birth control, I do not think it is realistic for Rick Santorum to represent America, end quote. Spector and Santorum had been closely connected when they were both in Congress, with Santorum endorsing Spector in 2004, Spector endorsing Santorum in 2006. While Santorum is now leading the Republican nomination pack of hopefuls, hopefully Spector's comments can help show just how radical and out of touch with America Ricky Santorum is. The bad. Virginia Governor Bob McDonnell. Just a day after Maryland passed same-sex marriage, McDonnell argued that while marriage equality should be left up to the states to decide, gays and lesbians make worse parents than straight couples, and therefore should be the last people allowed to adopt children. McDonnell said, quote, "An intact two-parent family is, in fact, the best for our country, should be the model, but when it doesn't work, we have safety nets." He went on to say that his research and data showed that a family with a man and a woman is always the best possible family. He said, I don't know what research McDonnell has done, but a great deal of actual legitimate research shows that gays and lesbians are just as good parents as heterosexuals and might even be better. It's time to stop using faulty research and phony statistics when trying to come up with a reason why America shouldn't embrace marriage equality. And the very, very ugly Mitt Romney. At this week's Republican debate, Romney announced that he was going to cut taxes to everyone by 20%. However, the only people who actually benefit out of this plan, no shocker here, are America's wealthy elite. According to the Tax Policy Center, half the benefits of a 20% reduction in all income tax rates would go to the richest 5% of Americans. A quarter of the benefits would go to, how surprising, the richest 1% of Americans. This means that those in the 1% would receive a $60,000 tax cut, while the uber wealthy, the 0.1% of Americans, would receive a whopping $264,000 tax cut. While Mitt Romney standing up to protect the wealth of America's elite is nothing new, it's quite clear he's still intent on letting the rich get richer and the poor get poorer, and that is very, very ugly. So, back to Anything Goes Friday here. Dan in Asheville, North Carolina, listening on Main FM 103.5. Hey, Dan, what's up?
Hey, Tom, I ask you this question because it infuriates me that Democratic presidential candidates so often try to appeal to independents. And my question is, why not instead doesn't Obama have the confidence to get in front of the American people and talk about his successes, his vision for the future, and simply ask or challenge independents to join the Democratic Party? Why not grow the party?
I think you're going to see a lot of that, Dan, once the Republican freak show finishes. You know, it's going to be, I think, March 23rd is the end of March, basically. By that time, we're going to know whether or not there's going to be a brokered convention, and if there is, by April or May or whenever their convention is, you know, they'll have a nominee. And the real campaign season isn't going to start until after Labor Day, you know, after the end of summer. And
but Tom, do you ever remember a president asking people to join in your lifetime?
His party?
And actually coming out and saying it?
No.
It just seems as head of the party, he should try to make it grow.
Yeah. I mean, good point. And if there's any Obama advisors listening, Dan's got it right. Thank you, Dan, for the call. I appreciate it. Thanks for listening to Main FM. I'm not part of the inside circle there, so I can't tell you what's going on. Tamara, or is it Tamara, in Ocean View, Hawaii?
Yes, it's Tamara.
Hey, Tamara, what's up?
Well, hi. I just want to say I wanted to address the health care and education as far as being childless. I believe in paying for education, but I also think that Congress and the House, if they can't refuse to agree on passing health care, then maybe we should take away their benefits and their salaries and their vacations until they can all come to the table and actually do their job.
Yeah. Well, at least take away their health care. I mean, yeah, I'm with you there, Tamara. They should be, I like a representative government. I want our representatives to represent us, not billionaires. That's why I want to amend the Constitution to strip out the idea of corporations as people and money as speech. But in addition to that, I think that, you know, our representatives need to be paid enough that they don't have to rely on the largesse of rich people, or only rich people can run for Congress because they're the only ones who can afford it. But I do think that the idea of kicking them upside the head with regard to health care is a good idea.
I agree, but also if they don't do their job, then don't we have the right to not pay them, or at least penalize them, or suspend them, or
you have to define what do their job means. And if they're making laws, even if they're laws we don't like, you can't say that they're not doing their job. They're showing up, and they're
They almost let the government shut down when that's not doing their job.
Yeah,
being stubborn.
Well, if they shut the government down, they should stop their own pay. I'm with you, Tamara. Thank you for the call, and thanks for watching us there in Ocean View, Hawaii. Judd in Tampa Bay, Florida, or Judo, I'm sorry, in Tampa Bay, Florida.
Hello?
Hey, what's up?
Hey, how you doing? First-time caller. I love the show.
Thank you.
Just got a quick question. How do you discuss issues with people that are just culturally conservative? Like, I live in Florida, and where I live, it's very conservative.
Right.
And, I mean, I've been able, you know, I've read a few books, I watch your show. I like to say I'm somewhat informed, and it's just, you know, you sit there and have a discussion for 20 minutes, and you debunk every single thing somebody says, and at the end of the day, they're still going to be conservative. You know,
sure.
It has to be a cultural thing. My parents come from Eastern Europe, so I knew as I was growing up, I had one point of view, and then as I was growing up, it became more and more American, you know, to the point where I'm just as American as you could possibly get, and I can understand the pushback when it's a cultural issue. So, like, how do you do it? I would really want to know, how could you discuss something with somebody when no matter what you say, it's going to go from one ear out the other, and they're just going to sit there and say, you know, they've been Republican all their life. It's like sometimes I've talked to people and I just look at them and they seem like their world is just upside down with the facts that I show them.
Relative to your point of view. I wrote a book about this, Judo, called Cracking the Code. And here's the nub of it. Here's the 20-second version of the book. People, to a large extent, people's political perspective is a piece of, it's part of the fabric of their sense of identity, of their sense of self. So when you challenge their political views, you're challenging their sense of who they are. And that's something that we give up very, very reluctantly. That's very dear to us, our sense of self, of who we are. And so if you go at it in that kind of blunt force fashion, typically it won't work. The most effective way to help somebody change their political views is by finding the parts of their sense of self that are inconsistent with their own political views. And not shoving it in their face like, nah, 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 but for example, saying, you know, somebody who calls themselves religious, calls themselves a Christian, and then says, you know, and I'm a gung-ho Republican. And you'd say, well, you know, that's very interesting. I understand that the core concept of Christianity, the very essence of Christianity, is captured in the Sermon on the Mount in Matthew 25, where Jesus said that if you want to be with me in heaven, that you have to feed the hungry, you have to heal the sick, you have to, you know, visit those who are in prison unjustly. In other words, we shouldn't be putting people in jail unjustly. You have to house the homeless, basically. He said, you know, clothe the naked, the same thing, and give water to the thirsty. I mean, these are the basic tenets of Christianity. And so if that's who you are, if that's your core identity is being a religious person or a Christian or an observant Jew or whatever it may be, you know, Muslim, fill in the blank, Mormon, I mean, they all share these values, right? If these are your values, then I don't understand why you would support a political party that doesn't support those values, but instead has as its highest value making rich people richer. Didn't Jesus say, you can't serve two masters at the same time? You can't worship both God and mammon. Mammon is, you know, money. You have to choose one or the other. I would go at it subtly and gently, but I would try to find the parts within them that they call themselves, where they have a sense of identity that is inconsistent with the political positions they're taking, and then gently point that out to them and not expect an immediate change. They're not going to say, oh, yeah, you're right, I guess I'll change my mind, because that is a fundamental change of self. But it will happen over time. And to me, the proof of it is, having done this radio show for 9 years, the incredible number of people who call into the show and say, you know, I started listening to you because I wanted to hear what the other side had to say. I've been listening to Limbaugh for years and years, and I always thought of myself as a conservative Republican, and you've made so much sense, and I've heard you have all these debates with these people, and now I get it, and now I consider myself a progressive. And thank you very much for enlightening me. And it's very rare that somebody calls up and says, you know, you have just confirmed my conservative worldview by your craziness or something like that. I mean, the rare occasions I get that kind of feedback, it's usually in the context of hate mail. I mean, it's just people who are so reactive because their sense of self has been challenged. But that's really where it all boils down to, is that sense of identity, of who am I, of self. Make sense?
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense.
And the really important thing is to see everybody as a human being. You know, we are all brothers and sisters. You know, mothers and fathers, daughters and sons. We all are a human family together. When you see the essential humanity of another person, it's a lot easier to talk to them.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
We'll take a few more of your calls, then we're going to check in with the Talk Radio News Service for our report on what's going on in the world today, and then Brunch with Bernie coming up in the next hour. Is that a rainbow I see out there by the Capitol building? Or is it just light coming out of the... I guess it's just light coming out of the clouds. It's amazing. Anyhow, welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Victoria Jones with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, brought to you by Ellen Ratner's new book, Self-Empowerment. Victoria is live at the White House.
I sure am.
Okay, so what's going on in that storied building?
Well, we have very very serious overseas news, but you must allow me a few seconds for my trending topic on Twitter, which is also news because it's unbelievable.
Okay, go for it.
Well, we'll start with Syria. As you may know, Secretary Clinton is in Tunisia today for the Friends of Syria meeting, which is about 70 countries and organizations who are meeting to discuss what to do with Syria, with the Syrian opposition. There are about 50 Syrian opposition groups, and there is part of the problem. They are trying to become unified, and of course they're not. They're very fractious, very disunified, coming from many different perspectives, and so they're trying to sort that out. Now, Qatar has called for an Arab force to impose peace in Syria. The Saudi delegation has reportedly walked out, complaining of inaction. British Foreign Secretary William Hague says the UK will recognize the opposition Syrian National Council as a legitimate representative of the country's people, and there is a move towards having the Syrian National Council as the legitimate representative. Also, apparently 66 people were killed in Syria today, according to the Syrian Revolution Coordinators Union.
Oh, my.
The European Union plans to freeze the assets of the Syrian Central Bank as of the 27th of February, according to Reuters. And the International Committee of the Red Cross is doing some evacuation of the besieged city of Homs. That is also going on. So the situation in Syria continues to deteriorate. Josh Earnest at the White House today did address it. He was asked to talk about the comparison with Libya and why we were not intervening, and he talked about how the UN Security Council was not united on this issue, and then was asked to speculate about whether it would be different if, in fact, Russia and China did come on board. He refused to speculate about that.
Yeah. Okay. Well, thank you very much for that. It's a horrific situation.
Horrific, and he talked about how it was horrific and outrageous, and it's truly a horrific situation. Horrific. Quran protests have resumed in Afghanistan despite the U.S. apology, and in fact have got much worse today. In Kabul, an estimated 4,000 people armed with rocks and sticks was surging along the Kabul-Jalalabad road in the east of the city, moving towards central Kabul. Western reporters have reported having to just run to get out of the way.
Now, all that said, today is Friday, so this is post-Friday prayers.
Exactly.
And that's the out of the 7 days of the week, that's the day when you see the spike of this kind of thing.
Exactly. This was the day that people were most concerned about. Now, of course, there has also been some disagreement in the Afghan parliament about how to respond to the President Obama's apology, which was issued yesterday in a three-page letter about other issues as well to Hamid Karzai. Now, there are some also who are saying, look, this incident is actually being exposed exploited for political gain. And some Afghans are saying that both Iran and Pakistan are manipulating it behind the scenes for their own purposes. Because they would like to see the Americans under pressure.
Sure.
Which is also interesting. And
which all goes back to, why did we get into this damn thing in the first place? It's, 10 years in Afghanistan. Well, don't get me started.
Precisely.
Yeah.
Precisely. And the Taliban has released two statements, one urging Afghans to attack foreign troops and installations, as well as Afghan forces who are defending them, and the second one urging Afghan security forces to turn their guns on their NATO colleagues. And as you know, somebody wearing an Afghan uniform, and I'm still not clear whether it was an Afghan soldier or someone wearing an Afghan uniform,
right,
killed two American soldiers yesterday. So I'm not clear about that,
okay,
who it was. This reporting has not been clear to me about that.
Okay.
Turning to American politics, there is a trending topic on Twitter called Cadillacs.
Okay.
And there is a quotation from somebody, and I will just give you the quotation, allow you to guess who said it. Ann drives a couple of Cadillacs, actually. Ann drives a couple of Cadillacs.
That would be Mitt Romney's wife?
That would be correct, sir.
Okay.
And that has now become a trending topic on Twitter. And if you read the tweets, it is almost uniform derision.
Yeah.
Mitt
met this as Ann drives a car made in Detroit, but it's the most expensive car made in Detroit, so that's what everybody's paying attention to, right?
And that she drives a couple.
A couple, yes.
She drives a couple of Cadillacs.
Yeah, of course. Well, they've got one at their mansion in California and one at their mansion in Massachusetts and one at their mansion in, I don't know what, Switzerland or something, whatever.
Some wags even going so far as to speculate on how could she decide which dog to strap. You know, which car to strap the dog to.
Right. Or maybe she's strapping a Cadillac on top of the other Cadillac, and then she straps the dog on top of the other cat. Or maybe that's what it is, Victoria. They're now letting the dog ride inside the car, and then they strap the car on top of the other car.
It's a sandwich. Meantime, Rick Santorum is desperately trying to recover from a very bad debate performance, saying today, unloading on Romney today in blistering remarks on several conservative media outlets, comparing himself with Romney, basically saying that Mitt Romney's teammates are all Democrats, even though he's been accused of taking one for the Republican team. We all know why, because Mitt Romney's teammates are all Democrats. Then he compares his record with Romney and ends up by saying basically that Romney supported his teammate, but the problem was his teammates were the Democrats, and saying that he will fight for conservatives and all Americans.
Meanwhile, Rick's old friend Arlen Specter came out this morning and basically said Rick wasn't qualified to be president of the United States, to represent the United States as president, so...
And Santorum also says the U.S. would lose its very essence if Obama is reelected.
Oh, my. How horrible. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Thank you, Victoria.
Thank you.
Bernie is up next.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Oh, and this has to be a special treat for our listeners on KPHX in Phoenix, Arizona. Live from Phoenix, Senator Bernie Sanders is on the air with us. Our Brunch with Bernie Hour here on the Tom Hartman Program. Senator Sanders, welcome.
Great to be with you, Tom.
A lot going on in the world, but it seems like Citizens United is always at the top of it, isn't it?
Well, Tom, you and I have talked about this issue, and I know increasingly all over this country, people are looking in disbelief when they see now these billionaires pouring huge sums of money into Republican candidates or in opposition to progressive candidates, and people are really scratching their heads and really wondering, is this what American democracy has evolved into, where a tiny handful of people working with folks like the Koch brothers and Karl Rove are now basically sponsoring individual candidates. You know, my state of Vermont, we believe in town meeting, we believe in one person, one vote, discussion, ideas. But clearly, nationally, it is just huge sums of money supporting political candidates. And by the way, let me be clear. This is the tip of the iceberg. Unless we overturn Citizens United, and unless we get some legislation passed in Congress immediately to diminish the impact of Citizens United, we can do that if we can get the votes. But bottom line is, if you are concerned about the economy, workers' rights, women's rights, education, healthcare, the environment, whatever it may be, you have got to be concerned about the denigration of American democracy through this absurd 5-4 Supreme Court decision. So we've got a constitutional amendment out there. Some other senators do. Good amendments. We have a petition on my website, sanders.senate.gov. We'd love to see people sign it. We've got over 200,000 signatures on it already. But it is a huge, huge issue which has got to be dealt with. And the second part of, I think, politically what the Republicans are doing is not only moving to a situation where a handful of millionaires and billionaires are backing their candidates. The other half of what they're doing is voter suppression. I authored a letter which has several of the senators on board, Senator Leahy from Vermont, Senator Bill Nelson of Florida, which basically asked for a GAO investigation into the so-called voter fraud situation. Under the guise of fighting voter fraud, Republican legislators and governors all over the country have passed some draconian legislation forcing lower-income people who may not own automobiles that before they can register to vote, they need to show a government photo ID, and many of them just don't have it. There's an effort to do away with early voting, which helps lower-income people, makes it easier for people to vote, and a slew of other ideas that these people are pushing and have passed simply to discourage and make it harder for people to vote. And I think I speak for the overwhelming majority of Americans who understand that in a democracy, people will have different points of view. We should respect different points of view. But the idea of going out of your way to make it harder for old people or poor people or college students or minorities to vote, my God, that is certainly not what American democracy is supposed to be about. So you got a two-pronged attack by Republicans. Number one, get big money increasingly involved in the political process through Citizens United, and two, do your best to lower voter turnout by keeping lower-income people from participating. And that's just an issue we have to be very focused on.
Absolutely. And this is one of the things you're talking about there in Phoenix as well.
Absolutely. Now, we talked to a wonderful group here. It's called Arizona Advocacy Network. They have long been involved with some success in pushing public funding of elections, and they are fighting off all kinds of Republican attacks. But they have done a wonderful job, and I was very proud to speak to about 600 people in Phoenix last night. The other issue that we're working very hard on in my office is the attacks on the Postal Service, which will result if the worst-case scenario were to unfold, and I don't think that would happen, but the Postal Service initial plan, and it's evolving now, would have been to, over a period of a few years, reduce the workforce of the Postal Service by 220,000 workers right in the middle of this terrible recession, which makes no sense to me at all, slow down mail delivery standards, which also makes no sense if you're competing against the Internet and email. We need a new business model for the Postal Service that has got to be more entrepreneurial, has to provide more services, has to make more revenue. But shutting down a significant number of processing plants all over this country that move the mail along is something that I'm very strongly opposed to. We're working with a whole bunch of senators who feel, as I do, that we have got to save the Postal Service, save the jobs, and get more revenue into the Postal Service. And there are approaches that we have that we think make a lot of sense. And I think there will be a comprehensive postal reform bill coming before the Senate probably in a couple of weeks. The other point that I wanted to make is that, you know, when the media covers the Republican candidates, there's a lot of focus on personalities or this or that aspect of what they're saying. But I think we should be very, very clear that if you lump these four guys together, you're looking at an a reactionary ideology and set of ideas which just are unprecedented
These guys make Barry Goldwater look like a moderate.
They make Barry Goldwater look like a moderate. That's exactly correct. I mean, and people should understand what it's about. It's they're going back to trickle-down economics. I just was reading today that Mitt Romney is going back to George W. Bush's economic advisors for help. Well, after 8 years of Bush's economic trickle-down theory, we lost 600,000 private sector jobs, worst economic performance for any president in modern history. And those are the moderates.
Right.
Those are the moderates that he's going back to. They're talking about, you know, they talk about getting government off the backs of businesses. That is deregulation. That is Wall Street. We did, against my very strong opposition, deregulate Wall Street. So these fine fellows could do whatever they wanted to do. They turned out to be crooks, engaging in illegal behavior, drove the country into a major recession where we are right now, but they want more deregulation. Free trade. They're not content that unfettered free trade has cost us millions of good-paying jobs. They want even more unfettered free trade so that American workers can continue to see a decline in their standard of living. And then what they say is, well, we're in a deficit right now, which, of course, was caused by the two unpaid-for wars, tax breaks for the rich and the recession. And they say, well, we got to cut Social Security. We've got to cut Medicare, Medicaid. Do away with the EPA. And not to mention in the last few weeks what we have seen, I think with Santorum's rise in the polls, is this, again, incredible attack on women's rights. The issue of abortion is nothing new. But to suggest that 99% of the women in this country who have used birth control at some point in their lives should be harder for them to get birth control is really almost boggles the imagination. And then we're back to a situation where, you know, these guys, despite all of the scientific evidence out there, forget acting to cut greenhouse gas emissions to deal with global warming. They refuse to acknowledge what almost the entire scientific community appreciates and recognizes, that global warming is real. It is getting worse, and that it is significantly man-made. So this is the agenda. You know, the media kind of loses focus and, you know, what role is Gingrich going to play and blah, 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 blah. But if you look at in a cold, hard way at what these guys stand for, this is the most reactionary set of ideas that this country has seen for a very, very, very long way.
Yeah, it absolutely is. It startlingly is. And I think, frankly, Bernie, Americans are starting to wake up, but hopefully we'll see. We'll see. Senator Bernie Sanders with us. It's our Brunch with Bernie hour here on the Tom Hartman program. And Senator Sanders will be taking your calls. Check out his website at sanders.senate.gov. He has a constitutional amendment to roll back Citizens United. You can sign on to it over there. He has a newsletter called the Bernie Buzz that you can get in your email box. And it's also his website is a great news source. Check it out.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Back with your calls for Senator Sanders in our national town hall meeting with the guy I think of as America's Senator, Bernie Sanders, right after this. Welcome back to the True People's Media, and it's Brunch with Bernie, our Brunch with Bernie hour. Tom Hartman here with you, and Senator Bernie Sanders taking your calls. Joe in Loxahatchee, Florida. Do I have that right, Joe?
Yeah, you got it right, Loxahatchee.
Okay. You're on here with Senator Sanders.
Well, why can't the Postal Service just raise the rates on stamps, like, say, another nickel? In Scotland in 1986, when I was there, it was 50 cents to mail a letter over there and 75 cents to send it to the United States.
Well, Joe, that's a good point, and that is actually one of the issues that is being considered, one of the solutions that is being considered. The more important issue, Joe, and a lot of people don't know this, is the Postal Service has financial problems, and one of the reasons is, of course, is first-class mail has gone down to be replaced by email. But what most people don't know is that a result of 2006 legislation pushed by George Bush, the Postal Service every single year has to come up with $5.5 billion. That's a huge sum of money for future employee health benefits. There's now $45 billion in that account, which really is all that is needed because it accrues interest. it is a stronger account than any other in America, whether it's federal, state, local, private sector. So one of the serious financial problems facing the post office is this onerous burden, which is an issue that we are trying to deal with. But raising the price of stamps a little bit, not quite as much as you're talking about, is another way to raise some additional revenue.
Len in New York City, you're on the air with Bernie, Senator Bernie Sanders.
Good afternoon. Before I get to my quick point, I would suggest that everybody who can't stand Rick Santorum vote for him if you live in Michigan, because you can. And keep him up there alongside Romney and let him keep fighting. But the reason I called was I'm sick of hearing on the media, in the media, that there's nothing that the president can do to keep gas prices from rising. And there are two specific things that he could do that or push for and get done. The first being increase the margin slowly on the all the exchanges for owning gas, so that you can't put down 10% on a contract of a barrel of oil and speculate with such a reward ratio. You know, increase it to 60-70%, so you have to pretty much buy the oil even if you're not going to take delivery. The second thing is, since, I mean, this is the same, I called up and blasted Norquist on C-SPAN the other week when, you know, the headline was that refined gasoline is our number one export. So why can't Obama strongly request in the media that across the board they put on like a 20% reduction in exports to all the companies to keep that gasoline here?
Well, Len, I think both of your points are well taken. Your first point deals with speculation. Many people don't know this, but oil is sold on the oil futures market. We believe that some 70-80% of that oil is owned not by people who actually use the oil, the airlines or fuel dealers, but are owned by Wall Street firms whose goal in life is to buy and sell that oil at a profit. And in doing so, they drive up prices. We have worked very hard to demand that the CFTC, the Consumer Products Trading Commission, impose strong regulations. They did something, but nothing near enough. And the other point that Len is making about gas being exported is also a good point and something that we should clearly be dealing with.
John in Santa Rosa Beach, Florida. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Yes, good morning. Afternoon. Mr. Sanders, a while back when Congress was voting on the threshold for estate taxes, I want to say 2009, I was curious what your opinion on that threshold was when it went up to $3.5 million. And currently, how do you feel about estate taxes? Are they too high, too low? And I have another point about our economy. I think it's very simple. There's a triangle of people involved in our economy. You have owners, you have labor, and you have the treasury. And just personally, I think if the process of production is going to change, two of the three ought to have more money, either owners in the treasury, owners in labor, or two of the three. I think it's that simple.
John, thank you.
Well, let me just say a word about the estate tax, and then we'll talk briefly about the economy. The estate tax was first proposed by Teddy Roosevelt about 100 years ago. And what he believed is, and what he worried about, was having a perpetual ongoing economic dynasty in America where the rich just gave their money over to the kids. The estate tax impacts, despite what you may hear from my Republican colleagues, and which they refer to the estate tax as the so-called death tax, impacts the wealthiest 0.3% of Americans. 99.7% of Americans don't pay a nickel in estate taxes. So to answer John's questions, I believe in a progressive estate tax. I think that it is absolutely appropriate that the wealthiest people contribute their fair share in taxes in general. And I certainly think the estate tax is one way you do it. I voted against the agreement that the president reached with the Republicans in 2010, which in fact made the estate tax even worse, gave more exemptions, and lowered the contributions that the wealthiest people would pay. I mean, you're talking about families, just a handful of families being able to pass on huge sums of money to their kids, and I think it is appropriate that we ask them to start paying their fair share of taxes. In terms of the economy, I think, John, maybe what you're getting at is that you're not going to have a strong economy unless consumers have money in their pockets, unless working people have money in their pockets, which is why some of us believe that we need a very strong jobs program. We need to extend unemployment benefits, because the way you get the economy moving is by putting cash in the hands of people who will spend it.
It is Brunch with Bernie here on the Tom Hartman Program. Senator Bernie Sanders taking your calls. We'll be back with more of your calls for Senator Sanders right after this.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
It's Brunch with Bernie. Check out Bernie's website, sanders.senate.gov. You can sign his constitutional amendment, and you can sign up for his newsletter, the Bernie Buzz. Welcome back. It's our Brunch with Bernie hour here on the Tom Hartman Program. Just a quick announcement for our listeners on WWRL in New York City. WWRL will be offering free tickets to this next week, but next week is the opening screening of a new movie called Heist, Who Stole the American Dream? You can get information about it over at the website heist-themovie.com. And Robert Kuttner, David K. Johnson, Nomi Prinz, Van Jones, and especially Senator Bernie Sanders star in that movie, and it is narrated by yours truly, so just a heads up. Bernie, welcome back.
Good to be with you.
So we'll pick up some phone calls here. John in Colorado Springs, Colorado. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Yes, good afternoon, gentlemen. As a follow-up question to how oil prices are being derived, has any government agency been putting any effort into finding out who is behind the black market or the dark market? I think it's known as the NYMEX.
I don't know the answer to that, John. The area that we have been focusing on is the issue of speculation and the absurdity that large Wall Street companies are driving prices up on the oil futures market. So I don't know the answer to your question, but that's where my office has been focusing.
Tony in Cleveland, Ohio, you're on the air with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Yeah, it's an honor to speak to you, Senator Sanders. I have a question. And although the current politics are so incredibly crazy, and it seems like we're being attacked from a zillion sides, it's hard to focus on all of these issues at one time. In the Postal Service, I know that in the Congress there was a couple of House resolutions. One was 2309, apparently, that would give the post office the ability to break contracts, strip unions of rights, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
There was another one called House Resolution 1351 that would actually protect the Postal Service. Now, I know that's what's going on in the House. I don't know what the status of those bills are.
Okay.
But could you inform the public as to what might be going on in the Senate and how we can push this?
Okay. The House has a very bad piece of legislation. I think it's written by people who ultimately want to privatize the post office and push it into bankruptcy and give the postal service the authority to break union contracts, et cetera, et cetera. Very bad piece of legislation. My understanding is they don't have the votes to pass it, because among many other things, what the original post office provision would do, their idea would be to shut down 3,700 mostly rural post offices. And whether you're a Democrat or a Republican, you know how important in small towns rural post offices are. They become, in many ways, the center of the town. They're more than just the post office. So you're getting opposition, as I understand it, in the House from both Republicans and senators. Republicans and Democrats in opposition to that bill. In the Senate, you have a bill that was written by Senators Lieberman and Carper, which is a much better bill, but in my view does not go nearly as far as it should. I recently authored a letter which now has 27 signatures on it, expressing the need to strengthen that bill. We've been meeting with Postmaster General, and the issue is here. We can't slow down mail delivery service because that will begin a death spiral for the post office. You can't do that. And when they do that, they're going to be shutting down half the processing plants in this country. Notices just went out the other day. They originally wanted to shut down 3,700 rural post offices. So we believe that by looking at this issue, among other things, of this onerous prepayment of $5.5 billion for future employee health benefits, we can stabilize the post office for the next few years, develop a new business model, giving it a lot more flexibility, moving it to an entrepreneurial enterprise, bring in more revenue, and that's the way we can save it.
Rick in San Luis Obispo, California, listening on AM 1340. Rick, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hi. I'm wondering if you could say what the what would be necessary to impeach the Supreme Court justices who voted for Citizens United.
Well, I don't think it's going to happen. And you know, I think ultimately the way you deal with these issues is by developing a very, very strong grassroots movement. And you can not only move to overturn Citizens United, which in my view was one of the worst decisions ever made by a Supreme Court in American history, but what we can also do, very importantly, before we get to overturning through a constitutional amendment, Citizens United, you can pass very significant legislation to significantly diminish the negative impact of Citizens United. Let me just give you a few examples. And by the way, I hope and expect this legislation to get to the floor very shortly. If I put an ad, any candidate puts an ad on television, they have to say, I approve this ad. And you get your picture up there in the corner. If we demand that the CEOs of the large corporations who are funding these ads, or the billionaires who are funding these ads, have to do it, you know what? They will be not very enthusiastic about having their face in front of millions of people. It's very bad for business. Right now, you have a situation where foreign-owned companies can actually put ads on American television in support or opposition to a given candidate. It's really incredible. We have got to end that as well, and we've got legislation to do that. You can move to legislation that says that if a corporation is going to put money into a political ad, it has to get the support of its stockholders because it's ultimately the stockholders' money. I think if we can move on those pieces of legislation in the near future, we can significantly diminish the impact of these super PACs. Furthermore, of course, long-term, we need a constitutional amendment to pass Citizens United. That's the direction I think we should go.
Amen, brother. Leon in Heathville, Virginia. You're on the air with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Yes, Senator, it's an honor. What can we do to create jobs that create jobs other than jobs washing dishes for the 1% or gardening for them?
Good question. You know, at the end of the day, Leon, that is the question that is on people's minds. Just a few points here. If you pick up the paper today or you watch the TV, they will tell you that officially unemployment is 8.2%. It is not. In fact, if you count those people who have given up looking for work, those people who are working part-time and they want to work full-time, unemployment, real unemployment, is closer to 15%. If you're a young person, if you're a minority, that number is even higher. So the caller raises the most important domestic issue that we have to deal with. How do we create millions and millions of jobs that we desperately need? And I think, frankly, the answer is not too complicated. Everybody knows in virtually every area of America, our infrastructure is collapsing. Infrastructure means roads, it means bridges, it means water systems, it means rail. We can put millions of people back to work over a period of years, rebuilding our crumbling infrastructure, making sure that our schools, that the schools our kids go to are in good shape, making sure that every community in America has broadband, good broadband service, good cell phone service. If we move in that direction, it makes our country stronger, more competitive, and it creates significant numbers of jobs. Leon, I would also say there are two other things that we can do immediately. We can transform our energy system away from foreign oil and fossil fuel to energy efficiency. In my state, we're doing well in getting homes, buildings, weatherized. We have a long, long way to go, and so does every other state in America. We can save massive amounts of fuel. We can cut back substantially on greenhouse gas emissions. And when you transform your energy system to energy efficiency and to wind, solar, geothermal, biomass, and make sure those components are built here in the United States, you also create a whole lot of jobs. And thirdly, as Tom and I have discussed for many, many years, we think that our current trade policy, NAFTA, permanent normal trade relations with China, etc., has been a disaster for American workers. I will tell you a very disturbing trend. The president talks about an uptick in manufacturing jobs in America, which is a good thing, because we've lost about 50,000 factories in the last 10 years and millions of good-paying manufacturing jobs. What the president doesn't tell you is that many of those new jobs being created in manufacturing are paying 20, 30, 40% less than they used to. So I think we've got to revisit completely our trade policy, demand that corporate America invest in manufacturing in the United States of America. So, Leon, those are just a few of the things that we could do to create jobs here.
Dave in Hartwell, Georgia, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Yes, thank you, gentlemen, for taking my call, and thank you both for everything that you do. My question is regarding a video that I've seen floating around the Internet talking about the likelihood that the U.S. dollar is in the process of being ousted as the world's reserve currency. My question really for Senator Sanders is this true? If it's true, is there anything we can do about it, and does it have the devastating, will the effects of that be as devastating as this video is claiming it to be? And I'll take the answer off.
I think there has been a lot of speculation about this on the Internet and elsewhere for a long period of time. So my guess is that it is not true. I don't think it's going to happen. I think the euro and Europe are in worse economic shape than the United States is right now. So I think that is not a likelihood.
Okay. And that said, I mean, the British pound was the world's reserve currency until World War I, and they're still doing fine with the pound, although I'm not saying that we shouldn't, but... I think that they're. I've seen some of these internet things, and they're pretty hysterical, Bernie. And it's just, you know, there's a lot of conspiracy theory out there. But your answer is spot on. We'll be right back with more of Senator Bernie Sanders. It's our Brunch with Bernie hour here on the Tom Hartman program, taking your calls at our national town hall meeting with the guy I think of as America's senator. Although having lived in Vermont for a decade, I can tell you the people of Vermont know that he's their senator. We'll be right back with more of your calls for Bernie Sanders.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And check out Bernie's website at sanders.senate.gov. You can sign his constitutional amendment to roll back Citizens United and sign up for his newsletter, The Bernie Buzz.
I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them bloom for me and you, and I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
Every Friday in our last segment, we play that song. It was my dad's favorite song, and we say our thank yous. Thanks so much to our show director, Louise Hartman, to our executive producer, Sean Taylor, to our associate producer, Jacob Dean, our video director, Jim Javinsky, our phone screeners, Paul Edney and Julie Lulley, our writer-researcher, Sam Sachs, to Alva Goldberg for video production, to our webmasters, Nigel Peacock and Jamie Holly, to our business manager, Ron Hartenbaum, to everyone at the various companies that syndicate this program in commercial radio stations, Dial Global, Pacifica Radio, on non-commercial stations across the United States, Europe, and Africa, and on Free Speech TV, carrying us on Dish Network, and on DirecTV, and all the cable providers who carry our show, Comcast, Manhattan Neighborhood Network, and all the others around the country, to Don Rojas, Dennis Trunov, all the other great folks at Free Speech TV and RTTV who work on The Big Picture, to our newsletter editor, Sue Nethercutt, to the folks in our chat room, to Ellen Ratner and Victoria Jones, and everyone at the Talk Radio News Service, to Jay Goodman Tamboli for tech support, to our affiliates, our sponsors, and to you for supporting our program. And a special thanks to Bernie for being with us every Friday. Bernie, sorry for the interruption there, but it's our Friday thank yous. Back to the phone calls here. Sue in Davie, Florida, watching on Free Speech TV. You're on the air with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Okay, I'm thinking that you're saying Sue in Davie, Florida.
I just did. You're on the air, Sue.
Okay, I missed the name part. I just want to let both Tom and Bernie know how much I appreciate them.
Thank you.
Great job, both of you. I mean, Bernie, you're one of the best senators I think the U.S. Senate has. Anyway, I wanted to ask a question again about the post office. that poison pill bill that was enacted in 2006 or passed in 2006, why couldn't something, another bill be written? Of course, it probably wouldn't be able to be written now since the Republicans own Congress right now, the House. But why couldn't they write another bill to stop that what are they being forced to prepay health care and retirement or something?
So that bill is
no other business has to do that.
So that bill has been written and I wrote it. So we have good legislation and there is support for that legislation. And one of the points we make is just the point that you raised. There is no other entity in the United States of America, governmental or private, that has the kind of burden that the Postal Service has in terms of prepayment of future employee health benefits. And according to the Inspector General of the U.S. Postal Service, who wrote this in a letter to me, he said there is now, I think it's $45 billion in that account. If it accrues interest over the next 21 years, it will be able to pay out all of the benefits that it has to pay off. We don't need to put more money into that account. On top of that, the Postal Service, and everybody agrees with this, has overpaid into various federal retirement programs another, I think, $13 billion. So the Postal Service has a cushion for the next few years. They do not need to lay off hundreds of thousands of workers and cut their workforce. They don't have to end half of the processing plants. They don't have to shut down over 3,000 rural post offices. We are working night and day on this issue. I think we're making some progress, but there will be a bill that will come to the floor of the Senate, I think, in about 2 weeks. It's always hard to predict, 2-3 weeks, and we hope that a lot of what we have put into our legislation will get passed.
Brenda, watching us on Free Speech TV in Lakewood, California. You're on the air with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Hi. It's an honor to speak with both of you, and thank you for taking my call. Despite the fact that the president denied the permit for the Keystone XL pipeline, TransCanada continues to bully landowners using eminent domain to condemn private property when people won't settle with them. I would like to know, I have actually two questions on that. One is, what authority does this foreign company have to continue to insist landowners to settle with them when there is a presidential denial of their permit to build and they're not a common carrier? And the second question would be, when will the government intervene on this? Because they're actually thumbing their nose at us and building this pipeline.
Well, let me start off with the second part, which I know more about. The president has come out strongly against the XL pipeline, and there are two issues there, one I think being more important than the other. Number one, obviously, you're going to need an oil pipe to carry the oil from Alberta to Texas. And people are concerned about the dangers of leaks from that pipe. And we already have a leak in Michigan, which has been very, very devastated. This is the dirtiest oil imaginable, and it is hard simply to clean it up if there is a leak. So the people in Nebraska, conservatives, said, hey, we don't want it going through our aquifer in Nebraska. And then the TransCanada said, okay, well, we'll move it in another location. That's one issue. But actually, there is a more important issue, and that is, are we serious about addressing the international global crisis of global warming, or are we not? The evidence is absolutely clear that global warming is already having a devastating impact today on our planet. It will only get worse in the next coming decades. And if we say that we are going to reach out and open up the tar sands oil, which emits 87% more greenhouse gas emissions than normal oil, and that's the oil we're going to become dependent upon, in many ways, you're kind of throwing in the towel in the fight against global warming. And I think that that is something we must not do. I think the sensible approach to energy is not going in that direction. It is energy efficiency. It's sustainable energy. If we invest heavily in those areas, we can, in fact, solve the energy crisis and start the process of reversing global warming.
Bernie, thanks so much for being with us this week and all these years. Thank you so much today.
Thank you very much, Tom.
Great having you with us. And you can check out Bernie's website at sanders.senate.gov. You can sign his constitutional amendment and roll back Citizens United and sign up for the Bernie Buzz. And coming up Monday, highway tolls to fix traffic jams and all the news. Don't forget, democracy begins with you. Get out there, get active, tag. You're it. We'll see you Monday.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to tomhartman.com.